I'd like to introduce Jerry from Glasgow.
Afternoon, everybody. My name's Jerry. I'm an alcoholic addict. It's excruciatingly fucking painful to be here, by the way, standing at that door, like a co-accused. I don't know if any of the rest of you have witnessed, but any addicts in the room, you can identify them. They've removed all the minibars, by the way. There's not one to be fucking seen in a corridor. But anyway, it's great to be here. I always take a minute or two to get settled, whether I'm in a room with six addicts or 60 or whatever it's. I need to get into perspective why I'm here. And I'm conscious of the fact that there's been a lot of effort put into this particular event, and it's the first one in London. And you know, it's a big ask when people get asked to do this stuff and put their shoulder to the wheel. We've got a lot of stuff that happens up in Glasgow. And I was never a fan of conventions until the last couple that I've been to. I went to one in Dublin, 2017. And I'll go back to that when there was a wee bit of thing happened to my health and all that stuff around about that time. And you know, the longer I'm in Cocaine Anonymous, the longer I'm in our sister fellowship, where we adopt the program at the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to the old timers in Glasgow and the fucking 420 meetings a week that they have there, where about a third of them are on the page of recovery. It's life-saving stuff, man. I'm one of these guys that tries to get rid of divisiveness between fellowships, man. It's fucking crazy. I originate for the Gorbals in Glasgow, which is a lovely wee village in the centre of Glasgow. And fucking spiritual tools ain't on the menu, by the way, in the pubs and clubs around about that area, but there's something happened, and we were speaking about it this morning at breakfast, myself, and I've got permission, by the way, to identify a couple of my friends that are here as well, and I know how we have to be serious about people's anonymity and all that stuff. And something happened in Glasgow about 18 years ago, where the whole kind of dynamics around about the Big Book get changed in certain meetings and stuff, and some of us that are here got the fruits of that, because I'm told for a lot of years in Glasgow it wasn't popular, it wasn't hip, it wasn't fucking trendy to speak about recovery. There's been a kind of explosion up there in the last 18 years. I'm so glad. I get in January the 11th, 2008, hammered into the ground by drug addiction and alcoholism. I've been in various states of disrepair over the years, and when I got into recovery, I was 43 and a half, and there was absolutely nothing left on the shelf of any sort of thinking that I could control and manage and enjoy, and go back to the halcyon days where we used to sit in the local pubs and smoke joints and drink Fustenberg and have lines of coke and all that stuff. There was periods when it was joyful. Now this was part of my journey when I actually thought I was managing things. I was in a scrap heap with heroin at the age of 16. I mean, I was fucking robbing my mother for money. She was the target for everything. The love and the nurturing and all the stuff that a father and a mother tries to give a child was totally lost on me at a certain age. See, I like to... The fact that I've got a wee bit older in recovery and I've been able to look at my life I could never ever identify with Bill Wilson until I was about 5, 6 years, when I took time to learn about this guy and what he was up against with his illness. And I started to identify. I mean, I was an awkward child, man. Still to this day, at 55 years of age, I still have that kind of heightened sensitivity, which is the fucking reason that I need to come here after 11 years. I'm completely bonkers. I have one thing in place, by the way, one thing in place, which is concrete, which is step one. Yeah, I've admitted that I'm powerless over cocaine, alcohol, any other mind-altering substance. And my life was fucking unmanageable around about the thought of using any of these substances. So by the time I got here, there was absolutely no reservations. I remember I had one when I spoke to a sponsor when I get in here, and I says to him, Tam, I says, there's a place just outside on the west coast of Scotland. It's called Saltcoats, right? We used to get the train there when we were kids. It was all we could afford. Today, people used to go to Spain. We used to go to fucking Saltcoats, man. And I remember coming into AA, and I was thinking to myself, do you mean I'll never have a fucking pina colada in Saltcoats, by the way? See, you're meant to share everything with a sponsor, the smallest. That was a reservation. It was identified as a reservation that I had in my thinking. And he's laughing. And it has to be shared. So getting that stuff ironed out in relation to, I'm powerless. Unlimited power here, finite. It's God. It's the spirit of the universe. It's whatever you want to call it. I'm actually on the coattails of the Lord, but I'm not here to tell anybody about that. That's my gig. That's what I do, and that's what I got to know through the 12-step recovery program. No, because I'm a ruptured Catholic that when you go to chapel and all that stuff. And the only time that you find me in chapels now is in a Saturday afternoon when I go to the cathedral. And I get a bit of peace. I've heard a few people speak about it, you know. And as much as when there's substances in my system and the allergy craves them, the soul that I've got in contact with fucking craves peace, you know. It wants away for this biscuit, predominantly. when I get, the guy that shared here last night, the boy from London, the boy Dan, was talking about it, he says, because this is where it all dwells. This is the inner sanctum up here. And it took me a while to get to know it, to get to understand it, and to get to feel it and embrace it and feel part of it. It was closed off for years because if you're sniffing gas and fucking glue and sticking your head in petrol cans at the age of 12, and my first drink was alcohol. And it was whiskey, and I'll never. I heard the girl that was up this morning. I remember every substance that I took. I remember every effect that every substance has had on me. I can remember what it does to me, or I can remember what it does for me. I can't remember what it does to me. And imagine us here, the effort and the pain that we've went through to get our arse on this seat and then we run about trying to fucking fix other people who haven't got a fucking scooby what they're up against and have to get burnt into the ground with defiance. And because the only reason I stopped taking drugs and alcohol is because there was blood pushing out of my rear end. My body was starting to give up. And the rationale around about me at that time was something has to be done here. And I remember all my 30s and all my 20s and telling myself the peculiar mental twist, I can chuck this when I want. You know, being that scrap heap heroin addict that I was at the age of 16, I was outcast for the family. I was the youngest of six. And, you know, my father, he was alcoholic, I believe. He was alcoholic. He had these kind of traits. I remember he used to leave the house. He used to leave the house. God rest him with his camel coat on and his pencil tie. And he used to leave pristine, man. And he would come back fucking soaked in urine and the bottles of beer and all that stuff that would be smashed, hitting off the poles and stuff. And, My brothers would have to, they'd have to quiet them with violence, and all this stuff was going on. We stayed in, we moved out the Gorbals up to a place called Provan Mill, which is another nice wee village in the northeast. And there was a lot of fighting and all that stuff. And me being the youngest of six, because my brothers came for the Gorbals, what they had to do was negotiate the territory and get for Provan Mill to Jermison, to the High Street, to the Gorbals, and back again. And what they used to have was their hatchets and their knives and stuff planked behind there. And there was many a night when I remember being, I heard two guys talking last night in a meeting here, it was fantastic. And one was talking about his past, and the other guy was talking about how he couldn't fit into that way of life. And that's the way I was. I was just a terrified kid that was watching. I just likened myself to like wee Maggie at The Simpsons. You remember how you used to get passed about with a fucking nappy on and a dummy sticking out of it? And I just remember feeling dead insular and no very out there. And substances for me was a way to escape. It really was. I mean, if you'd have told me that cocaine and that alcohol and heroin and all these things were not the problem, I wouldn't have understood that. I had to understand that these were the solution to the problem, and the problem is that I cannot live sober. I can't live peaceful sober. Is what they call it in the book. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. And that's my natural condition. Some other geezers are have that type of thing, and they don't have the prial, they don't have the allergy, they don't have the obsession, but have these fucking compulsive things that's going on in their life, and they're propelled into success, or they're propelled into disaster. We don't talk about relationships, or the fucking 13 failed ones in them as well. I'm top drawer at that as well, by the way. But the thing is that my journey went to the extremes of, you know, I had an uncle who died with Korsakoff's. We used to find him lying in the street in his own faeces and stuff like that. And eventually we buried him. He went into a hospital, he went into a treatment center and defied it to the end. Insanity or death, man. It's a peculiar illness. And for anybody in here struggling with that sort of dynamic around about the thinking, we just have to get to our own level. You know, I hope there's people in here. If there's one person in here today, get something out of what I'm saying here, the job's done. My primary purpose is to stay sober, is to carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic addict. That's why we came down here. That's why we be part of. But if you see the guy that I was last week was the guy that was trying to manage life without a meeting. We getting by on this fucking top piece where I have to phone my sponsor and I have to get humble. I was talking to Con about it. The only one that I've got right is step one. The rest, I hope that I get them rang for the rest of my life, a day at a time, so that I can stay fucking close enough to God to try and get them right. And that might sound a bit mad, but the process for me has been, I don't find it spirituality. I don't find it happy, joyous, and free. It's been a slog. But I tell you what's a worse slog. Being out there using and trying to find ways and means of using and getting hammered into the ground with chemicals. And fuck knows what's going on out there now. I mean, it's spice, it's all these different things. And in Glasgow, we've got. See, we were talking about it last night in a meeting here. Everybody in here is through the eye of the fucking needle. And Bill Wilson talks about it in the big book. He says close by thousands are dropping off daily. Now, I've been here for over 11 years. Yeah, it gets harder. It gets It gets more, the road becomes more narrow. The circle becomes smaller. Your assertiveness has to be more assertive. Your people pleasing and your whole feelings are where all that takes you has to get reduced through you running yourself into the ground with certain areas of your life. And that's my experience. I remember when, you know, I came through all the drug scene. I was a hopeless heroin addict at the age of 16. I was fucking annihilated, man. I would have robbed my granny. I would have. I probably did, and I can't remember. Nobody was safe, right? I got put into a rehab at the age of 21, and I came out of that rehab bulletproof. Fucking bulletproof. I was never touching smack in my life again. The 5 year, the six, for 16 to 21, or whatever it was, years I had. Prior to getting into that rehab at 17, my dad died with cancer at the age I'm of now. I'm just approaching 56. He died with lung cancer. I was stealing his Dikies and hitting them up in the toilet, stealing his morphine, stealing my mother's money that she was working hard for as a cleaner. I mean, that's the levels that I'm at 16 years of age, right? So I get into this rehab at 21. I get separated from smack. That was what happened. 12 months later, I came out of there completely and utterly crazy. Emotionally shut down for the first time that a substance went into my fucking system at the age of 11. I don't know how to communicate. I can't look people in the eye. What a beautiful thing that is today, to be able to look about and look right into the soul of another individual and connect with them. I couldn't do that. The big book talks about the unmanageability, the second part of the, I learned about the allergy. I identified with the allergy immediately when I came in here. I couldn't get my thinking around about the mental obsession, the idea that it was going to be different. I couldn't get my head around that. And for years and years, what happens to me is I get separated from the smack, and I pick up. My illness strategically places me in front of other substances so that I can deny that one to allow me to take that one. So it was skunk in fucking Fustenberg for about 8 years, from 21 to 28. And I don't know if anybody's experienced smoking skunk and drinking Fustenberg, but you get yourself a snooker cue so you can fucking turn the telly off and stuff like that, turn the lights off. You fucking lie there for about a fortnight before you get a wash. The easy way out. But I'm functioning. If my brother got me a job, and when I turned up, I was no bad actually. He got me a job as a sales guy for him, and at the age of 28, I end up picking up cocaine because I'm looking at heroin addicts getting into the chemist for their meth. Now, bear in mind, I went on to Phycetone at the age of 17, which was pill-type methadone at the time. I didn't know what an addict was then, but I'm looking at all my friends or my ex-school pals getting into the chemist for their meth, and I'm saying, what a fucking nick they're in. Yeah. Meantime, I'm starting to get right in about the coke, and I had a love affair with cocaine. I had a fucking love affair, but it came in front of everything. I loved it. I used to sit in the Kingston Bridge, pouring it onto my fingers and sniffing it at the traffic lights and every fucking thing. I loved it. But I could get by for days. See, it's a peculiar mental twist that's been acquired. It's the denial process. This is why I couldn't get my head around it. I had to have a CV in place of all my failed attempts. I tried to stoke this stuff by the time I got in here. And I remember I used to lie in the fetal position on a Monday. I stayed with my partner at this time, Linda, who became, excuse the pun, by the way, who became like a kind of cash cow for me. Yeah, she paid all the bills. paid for everything. And I'm running about like fucking Oliver Tobacco, by the way, trying to run about with all the birds and the gorbals and all that stuff. I had nae value system around about how to treat another human being. She was paying the mortgage, she was paying my coke debts, and I treated her like a landlady. That's what I done with her. I treated her like a landlady. And it went worse. By the time I hit my 30s, I'd always been under surveillance with cirrhosis of the liver and all that stuff. I'm kind of, in 1979, 9 out of 10 intravenous drug users in Glasgow had hepatitis C, and I was one of them. I drank vodka and tapped with that for years, and used coke and all that stuff. And by the time I get in, I've had 15 years ago, I was in hospital with tuberculosis, pneumonia, hepatitis C and cirrhosis of the liver. That's my fucking trophy cabinet, by the way. and I'm lying there in the bed, and I'm the colour of that pillow, man, and I'm like a science project. They're all in, you know, the wee students, so fucking, is he breathing and all that stuff? And they said, Mr. Notts, when you leave here, you cannot take a substance. Any description, okay? It's totally out of the question. We're going to put you on Rifiter and Refiner, which is TB medication, for 18 months. And without a thought of anything else other than what came in was, I'll just drink wine when I go home. I won't drink vodka, okay? I'm limited in fucking power, by the way. I have absolutely none. And that was an experience of thinking that I was up against with everything that I came up against as far as using was concerned. I would get periods, I would get a few quid, everything would be rosy in the garden, and then boom, it would just come in subtly, ever so subtly, and just say, a half a gram. I don't even know what half a gram fucking looks like. And a half bottle. I've never ever had a half bottle of anything either. And Delma, she says to me, I need to mention this because there was a time when I just isolated in the house with kind of bags. I had disposable income, right? I had a few quid, and I would just sit there with half ounces, quarter ounces. I would run out. I would run out of the Summerfield, it was called at the time, and I would get myself a 40-ounce of vodka, 200 fags, and I would just sit there and fucking smoke for about 3 days, and my eyebrows would be covered in soot. Come Tuesday, and I would try and negotiate something to eat, you know. I would think about something to eat, but I wouldn't really fucking eat anything. And this was the kind of display. I love it, man. I remember I used to drink the vodka and feel the heat it going down into my cirrhotic liver and think, oh, she's fucking brilliant, by the way. And there was pleasure in my pain. Trust me, that's where I was at. And something happened, right? I better get on to the solution, right? Because the solution is why we're here, innit? But if anybody identifies with that type of thinking, right, it means that I'm powerless over the idea. I cannot manage the decision of whether I'm going to use them, though, right? So I have to concede. A man of most self, and I don't know that I'm doing this at this point, but I cry out to a friend of mine who lives down here, Big Desi. Go on the phone to him, and I'm desperate, man. The desire to stop has just started to kick the door down, and they get me to a meeting, they get me to the crypt, and I'm it's an AA friendly, addict friendly AA meeting. They kind of bend the fucking traditions just to get us wedged in the door, right? And I turn up there, we covered in urine, and like my Uncle Eddie, God rest him, and all that pattern is emerging, where I'm heading over the edge, man. And I get into that meeting, and I cry out for help. You know, the guy was outside the meeting, and he says to me, I says, Alec, I says, I can't stop. He says, Jerry, you've no mental defence. I never knew what that meant. It's all the wee stuff that makes it so important to me today, because it's all configurated in when the God of my understanding starts to navigate me through this process. And or a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience was starting to kick in. He says to me, I had used with Alec and I had been friends with him since we were kids. There was something about him. There was something about his whole deportment that was different. His body language was telling a different story, man. He had a glint in his eye. And he was looking at me like somebody who was nearing the end. And I remember he says to me, he says, Jerry, he says, if I don't keep a hold of you for the next 3 weeks at least, he says, I don't think we'll see you. He says, I think it was coming to that point. And I remember what he done was he dropped me off that night for the meeting. Dino and another couple of pals of mine, wee Russell's here. He was there. He reminded me that he was there. He's 2 days clean, by the way, my friend. I've been known him for 12 years. He's here today, man. It's great to still have him in my life, man. You know what I mean? And all my Glasgow friends, man, they touch my heart, every one of them. The thing about it is that the process was kicking in. Alex says to me, I had 400 quid in my pocket, right? Belonged to somebody else. Fucking no way 400 quid was belonging to me, I can assure you. A pot to piss in. He says, Jerry, I'll take a hold of that and hold on to it for you. Now, I remember Alec of old, right? I hadn't seen the transformation. I just knew that he looked different, right? I didn't know that he'd go honest. Well, kind of honest in his affair. But he says, I'll take that 400 quid and I'll hold on to it for you. He says, no chance, Alec. So I went and I done it in. And when he left me that night, I got a bottle of vodka. I drank it out of a cup. Bump. I'm back to that meeting. January the 11th, 2008, and that was the last that I'd had a substance, which was that weekend. I called my sober date January the 11th. That's when I went back to the crypt meeting, and then this fantastic process kicked in. Within a 16-week period, I was through the steps. I got a sponsor in a meeting in Glasgow, a big book study meeting in Priest Hill, which is in the kind of south end of the city. It became my home group for quite a while, for a long time, for about 8-9 years. The guy who sponsored me through the steps, there was a guy in here talking about sponsorship this morning. What can happen in a matter of weeks can seldom take fucking years. And if you want to run a book, getting psychiatrists hundreds of fucking money, and try to put a label on this, eh? I hear there's even fucking people charging, by the way, to get through the fucking steps nowadays, man. What a disgrace, by the way. Fucking tampering with the Holy Grail. There is no price in this stuff. It's been given for nothing. It should be freely given. Yeah. Anybody that's struggling with that, come up to Glasgow and we'll take you through the steps, man. Get yourself in the fucking Tulip Hotel and we'll take you through them. And what happens is, I get pulled through the steps with a vision because I've surrendered completely and utterly. The guy that took me through the steps had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 20-odd years without a program. And he was fresh out of the wrapper of a spiritual experience that he'd had 3 months prior. And he was taking me through the steps. He'd been through the steps 3 months. And he was taking me through them. And all he ever done was talk about his girlfriend that left him, by the way. Fuck you. It's like something out of Reader's Digest, man. I was sitting with my fucking... He says, I hope he gets back with that bird, man. but he outlined to me that the process that we were going through was... It was something that was magical. It really was. It's a miracle. And he told me that the God of his understanding, the loving, caring energy that embraces us all in here, whether you like it, whether you don't, whether you're happy with it, whether you're hostile with it, is there. And he says that turns up to make two people heal. Yeah? Eyeball to eyeball contact. And all of a sudden, this heart valve starts to open and starts to embrace the love that he's been given for this process. Freely given, by the way. No axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. A sincere desire to be helpful. A, I'm alcoholic. B, no human power is going to relieve my condition. And C, God could or would if he were sought. And for anybody that's got a problem with that word or the whole ethos round about it, we can call it a good, orderly direction. Okay? And bang, he takes me. I understand now. I'm going through a fourth step, and I understand now. I seen my part in everything. I was ready. I gave God everything. Everything. Apart from my sexual conduct. Fucking running about meetings like Bill Wilson with a big boot under my arm, leaving the meeting, going to a massage parlour. I've been cured. I get sat. By the way, I did for about 18 months. I was in and out of them. I love the feeling. You see, I get a feeling at other people's expense. You see, this is what happens, and sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Yeah. Fucking spiritual guru, I don't know. We had to address it, by the way. We had to address it. We had to get a sex idea with a big book. Pings it out and clear. It's emblazoned. It's as fucking clear as day, man. It's like that sign there. We need to have a new way to conduct ourselves in life. We're the other side of our species. And see, I didn't know anything about any of that. I was a caveman when I came in here. I was a fucking caveman. Cocaine Anonymous, the process through Cocaine Anonymous has helped me to become a member of society again. A functioning member of society that gets up in the morning and hods doing a job now and tries to do things by honest means, right? I mean, I fail miserably in certain areas, man. Sometimes I can't get honest. Sometimes I don't want to. Something happened to me last year. I was telling you I was under surveillance with a liver clinic, right? And this is what happens when you go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. What happens is you get a spiritual awakening, right? That's sufficient to recover from alcoholism and drug addiction. But it's also something that you can use to solve all your problems. All of them. Every one of them. Right? And it all hinges on what a day after I find out about step five. What am I prepared to give God? What am I prepared to hang on to? Is the pain going to get such that I'm going to go back out and use again? Or do I get honest? Do I get real? And do I bring him in? And just a bit of it. Sure, there was periods that have been like that. But they diagnosed cancer 2017 on my liver, a 3.5 centimeter tumor. And right away, my rear end goes completely, man. I'm going to die, man. I hope they play this tune at my funeral. No, it's all that stuff. But something quickly comes back in when he mentions the word, right? And I think to myself, I don't know where this came from, by the way. And it doesn't make me any better or any less than anybody, right? But we've got a hospital in Glasgow called York Hill, and there's kids in it with leukemia and all that stuff. And that was the first thought that came into my mind. That's a God thought, right? That's a good orderly direction thought. Jerry, there's children with leukemia that don't even know that they've got it. They've diagnosed me with something, and they gave me four options around about it, right? And the first one was that they were going to give me a transplant or a liver resection, which is really good. And they call it a chop out, by the way. Fucking nice language for a surgeon, isn't it? A chop out. That's what happens when you don't pay your coke bills up in Glasgow as well. Yeah. I kind of registered with that one, do you know what I mean? Or they were going to use all these kind of new things that they do to give you localised chemo up your groin, all that stuff. And so I thought to myself, I'll have a new liver, thank you very much. No even thinking that somebody's going to fucking die before I get it, eh? And then I get convinced that the best route to market is to do the liver resection. So they do it. And I went into the hospital last year in the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh, it's like taking your mini into the guy that knows what he's doing with a mini, right? You come back out battered and bruised, but you're still a mini. And they take this thing off my liver. And I'll tell you how grateful I am for that, right? See, I had a friend, God rest him, he died 3 years ago. He'd never ever get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that peculiar mental twist had denied him the honesty to get real. And like a picture, they diagnosed him in the November 4 years ago, and come March, he was gone. He was gone. They diagnosed me November 2017, April. I had it removed. That's the difference. See, I'm glad I'm an addict. There's a blessing in there somewhere. But what happens is they put me on, I start to get all interested because they're going to put me on Class A drugs. Wow, man. Ketamine and fentanyl, man, fucking hell. I thought you only get ketamine at parties, by the way. I didn't know you got it in the hospital. But I remember getting in there and the trepidation. The trepidation, you know, and I'm like, is that the stuff that the GMG and all that, and Michael Jackson, is that the stuff that he was taking? And getting all excited about it. It's my thinking. But before I went in there, I've got a friend of mine who had two hip replacements, and he had to go on Class A drugs. Yeah. So see that value system that I never had around about my parents and around about every relationship that I'd ever had in my life, because I didn't have one with myself. I've now got one with myself. There's a value system in my recovery, in my sobriety, that has to come first. It has to come first. So before I go in there, I talk to a guy who sober sponsors me after Class A medication. Yeah? I don't know if anybody's been on Class A medication and you're a junkie and you're a fucking coke addict or you're an alky. It's a fucking problem, right? So we need to address it. And he told me a couple of things. He says, Jerry, he says, as and when required, what are you taking it for? And when are you taking it? And what's your pain threshold? So that was a good outline for me. And I asked myself the questions. They hit me when they took the morphine driver out and the ketamine after 3 days. I had this. I looked like something out of fucking Don't Watch Alone movie, man. I'm lying there, and they were giving me oxycodone, hillbilly heroin, by the way, as you call it, and they were getting out there on the street. And you can have as many as you want, they said. The slow release and quick release. It's like fucking ticking a menu, man. Okay. And for a couple of days, I'm in that much pain, I'm enjoying them. And until she comes in one day, it's about the third day on them, and she says, the wee nurse comes in, and she says, what would you like for breakfast, Mr. Knotts? And I said, go put Lou Reed on. She knew who Lou Reed was. That was somebody I used to listen to when I used to get full of smack. But see when I left there, right? I left there with a strip or a couple of strips, 5 mil oxycodone, and I'm responsible for my recovery. See, I need to phone somebody when I'm taking them, and I need to ask myself why I'm taking them. And I'm able to throw them down the toilet pan after a couple of weeks. Okay? That's recovery. That's what being responsible in recovery is, right? For me, every relationship that I dented, that I didn't know how to treat people, that I didn't know how to love them because I didn't know how to be loved, etc., I've mended quite a few. I am a broken soul on the mend, and I fucking embrace that every day now, yeah? Especially when you get the thing like a secondary illness, it's as serious as that. It puts everything into perspective, man. It really does. I'm a kind of nomad at the moment. I don't have a home group, and they're all staring at me going, how the fuck are you clean if you've not got a home group? But the thing is that Saturday Night Fever is doing well without me, by the way. Eh? I thought we were going to have to shut it down when I went into the fucking hospital, man. So I get a perspective on life, and I'm enjoying meetings. I'm enjoying being in recovery. I'm enjoying being here. This is a celebration of recovery, right? But there's people in here who are sliding down the walls with their fingernails as we speak, okay? And we need to be there for them. we just a wee quiet word and a wee bit of help and stuff like that. And that's what I aim to do when I'm here. If there's anybody struggling that I can have a chat with and it takes my mind off of me for a while, I'm glad to do it, man. But I hope to continue. I hope God has got other plans for me other than the ones that I've got, because it'll be a couple of fucking dancing girls and a half ounce of fucking Charlie in my house if I get my way. So what I'll continue to do is tap into him in the morning, and I'll continue to meditate, and I'll continue to turn up when I'm asked. And that's what I've done. But I hope I've not bored or offended anybody. I'm glad to be here. Clean and sober, thanks. Yeah.